Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Stephen Chaikaitis about his new book, The Composition of Movements to Come, Aesthetics and Cultural Labour After the Avant-Garde, which is published by Roman and Littlefield. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Stephen Chaikaitis from Essex University about his new book, The Composition of Movements to Come, Aesthetics and Cultural Labour After the Avant-Garde. So, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me, Dave.
This is a fascinating and rich book, and very actually very timely as well, given the kind of politics we're seeing in the US, the UK, and actually much more globally as well. And I wonder if we could start off just by kind of introducing the context for the book. So I wonder if you could kind of tell me about the sort of work you're doing at Essex, and particularly the kind of, I guess, sort of like political starting point for your work.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, when I tend to write books, there tend to be three or four different things going on at the same time. Like there's like a conceptual story. There's like a story coming out of political organizing. There's something coming out of art, and there's different layers coming together. But sort of what this book comes out of is, I guess you'd say, certain experiences in the anti-globalization movement in the late '90s, early 2000s. Where there was a real focus on what was called sort of the idea of diversity of tactics, or the idea that you have sort of network forms of organization that didn't have top-down leadership, and that didn't have like forms of centralized coordination. And this is something that, you know, we saw a lot as well with the Occupy movements and things like that. And what I thought was interesting was the ways that it was sort of considered very taboo to talk about things like strategy, because that seemed to come with it a whole baggage of sort of top-down concepts and centralized control. So what I wanted to think about was something like, are there ways to think about political strategizing that don't operate in that sort of top-down fashion? And could forms of, let's say, radical art production be ways that political movements like reorient themselves and think collectively through questions of strategy? So that's what I wanted to do, is sort of look at forms of avant-garde art production using mainly sort of forms of Marxist theory to try to understand this conjunction or possible conjunction of art production, social movements, aesthetics and strategy.
That actually sets up a really good question about the book, which is the kind of like theoretical position. And I guess the kind of like the core part of Marxist theory that you're drawing from. So we can crystallize this around the question of kind of what is autonomism? And yeah, what's the connection between that and art?
Autonomism is perhaps generally known, or autonomous Marxism is generally known in the English-speaking world, mainly through the works of people like Antonio Negri, Paolo Virno, Franco Berardi, and things like that. I'm drawing from them a lot, but also from, you might say, what I was jokingly referring to for a while as Brooklyn autonomia. So certain people like Sylvia Federici, George Kafensis, the Midnight Notes Group, Harry Cleaver, who ended up in Brooklyn in the mid-70s, trying to draw on certain ideas and practices coming out of the radical politics of Italy during the time, but also bringing them together with questions coming out of the wages for housework movement, social feminist politics, and also sort of more, let's say, post-colonial, decolonial politics. So that's what I would generally think of as autotomism, as being a kind of Marxism that is, let's say, I don't want to split hairs here, but sort of a non-state Marxism that is tries to find how class relations are constantly composed and recomposed through how labor antagonism is sort of dealt with, how it's mediated. And one that I find more interesting because it's not so, say, dogmatic or so programmatic. Now, in terms of how that relates to art, the obvious answer was, well, usually not very much at all. I mean, it's a form of Marxist politics and analysis that comes out of first industrial labor struggles and focus on labor, and thus, at least at first, doesn't really even talk about art per se. I mean, once Negri starts talking about socialized labor and forms of communicative labor starting in the 70s, you could start seeing how that could overset with art practices. But it's not really been a major point of overlap between, you know, on that kind of political analysis and the art world. Although there are moments here and there where you could see artists who have worked with political figures, or you could see how these two things have come together, but it's not been a major theme. So I was trying to sort of see what would happen if we use this school of thought to look at, you know, certain art practices. I think it worked relatively well.
And it's funny you mentioned kind of certain art practices, because you've got a very kind of eclectic approach actually to the range of different types of artistic and cultural expressions across the book, which I think is one of the book's strengths. One thing you're particularly interested in, though, is this idea about the kind of the avant-garde in the book. And I wonder, actually, could you sum up that as well? Because as you say early on, it's a sort of a slippery term, isn't it?
Mm. Well, one thing that's funny is that because I work in a business school, I'm allowed to sort of, I allow myself to sort of take certain riskless concepts that would, let's say, be a lot more, faux pas if I was a proper art historian. So, for instance, if you look at most art historical research, it tends to sort of, you know, end the idea of the avant-garde around the mid-60s. So to talk about the avant-garde today would be kind of a big no-no, because it's like, well, isn't it over? I'm interested in the avant-garde in almost a kind of sense that of how, like, Ranciere talks about the distribution of the sensible. So I'm interested in avant-garde not as, let's say, the leading edge of the sort of, you know, of the best political art, which is going to somehow miraculously lead the struggle. I'm more interested in sort of forms of aesthetic or cultural production that disrupt and transform what is sayable in a current situation. So that's sort of my particular take on the avant-garde, and that's for two reasons. One is this book is primarily historical in the sense that it's looking at things coming out of mainly the 60s, 70s, and 80s. But it's looking at them in a way that's trying to figure out how their approach to their present, the context they were operating in, could be useful for thinking about aesthetics and politics today. So in a certain sense, I'm using the idea of the avant-garde more as a sort of as a conceptual category than necessarily as sort of, you know, as a sociological one.
The I guess the first kind of example draws us back actually to that kind of more traditional art historical moment, and this is the Situationist International. So I wonder, could you tell me how they're important to the book, and how they might be kind of read as an unorthodox form of strategy?
Yeah. One thing I find interesting about the Situationists, a few things. One is you find that there's certain, let's say, groups of theorists or artists or ideas who tend to constantly get recirculated and reused. So, for instance, when we look at the SI, you know, you have basically a sort of strange conjunction of a kind of Hegelian Marxism with a kind of, you know, radical aesthetics inspired by Dada and Surrealism, with a combination of let's say, a focus on sort of media politics and communication. And a lot of the ways that the SI tends to get talked about tend to reduce them to one aspect or another. So you can have, let's say, the way that they talk about where they become a part of the art world proper, and you look at them in art historical terms. Or if you have the SI where they become, you know, like, how were they were part of a certain history of Marxist thought. What I'm interested in is, and the way I approached it, which is maybe, you know, I'm not saying this is the way to approach them, is when you look at sort of, particularly some of Guy Debord's later writings, it's really interesting how he was also very influenced by von Clausewitz, by sort of classical military strategy. So I wanted to start thinking about like how could look at the various kinds of practices that they were undertaking as forms of trying to collectively strategize. So to give you an example, let's say the traditional Marxist conception of the party is that the working class can only reach trade union consciousness, therefore it is the job of the party to come in and bring consciousness to people, right? I mean, I'm being simplistic here, but let's say that's the general idea. What the SI is supposed to do is they say, we don't want to lead here. We want to, I think they use the phrase, we want to initiate the explosion and then sort of to disappear. So they want to create conditions of emergence, which a sort of collective subject will emerge and then begin to strategize for itself. So things like, let's say, interrupting everyday life with sort of street theater or trying to create situations of occupation of buildings are not because, as I think, it's going to correctly, like, you know, lead political struggle in a certain direction, but rather it will create a situation out of which a different kind of collectivity will emerge that will strategize for itself.
I wonder if you could kind of develop that with the concept of psychogeography, partially because it's a kind of well-known idea that comes from the Situationists, but also it provides a useful bridge into thinking about how these kind of strategies take place in the urban context, which is one of the kind of bigger themes the book develops.
Yeah. So when the SI is starting in the late 50s or early 60s, Paris, like many places in Europe and many places in the world, is undergoing a huge shift as sort of the growth of cities, this sort of, you know, the transformation in the economy, rising consumer culture. And so psychogeography emerges as trying to find a different way to encounter and relate to the urban fabric. Now, if you want to, you know, one way of rendering it is sort of an aimless drifting. We just sort of, you know, casually explore the city and see how it affects you. The way I was approaching psychogeography is more of almost like sort of quasi militaristic sort of surveying of the terrain of cities to see what forms of power are operating here, what forms of social conflict are possible within them, and it's almost there's a certain reading you can get out of Debord's writing on psychogeography, where he's trying to use psychogeography as a way to anticipate how, let's say, future conflicts in the city will take place based upon the way it's operating. So that's how I would tend to think about it, is it starts as an artistic method to explore the city differently with an idea of gaining a different relation to it that will be useful in future political conflicts.
Yeah, and I guess you can see where the kind of, I suppose, kind of military strategy, the game of war, these kind of ideas tie in quite neatly and quite usefully to that.
It's actually funny that there isn't more of a discussion of relationship between, you know, artistic avant-garde and military theory, given that the avant-garde is directly out of military theory, right? And I think it's one of the interesting things is, when I talk about military theory, I don't want to make, you know, Debord seem like too serious and too icy, because there is a certain degree of humor in the way he uses these ideas and a certain degree of playfulness in them. It's also interesting, I really like the idea that the SI was particularly conscious of the idea that they were going to intervene, but the goal of an artistic avant-garde is to have its day in the sun and then to disappear. So, for instance, when people talk about the Esai, they often say, like, oh, yeah, that was good, but they were only around for a little bit and then they were gone. Sometimes if an idea circulates and becomes, let's say, effective within a social milieu, you no longer need the organization to exist. So sometimes its temporariness is not a problem, but it's actually kind of a solution.
I mean, this actually is something that I suppose casts light on the idea of the avant-garde itself, and maybe, you know, why traditionally it does kind of seem to finish in late 60s or early 70s in art history, and again, you know, a way of kind of resuscitating it or kind of, you know, redeveloping it for the contemporary age, which is quite an interesting, I suppose, strategy of the book in itself.
Well, I think in particular why discussions of the avant-garde tend to shift or change or seem to end around that point is you also have broader shifts in the workings of the culture world and the economy, where you start to have the rise of what we now call post-Fordism or the creative economy, and certain things which could seem to be, let's say, purely antagonistic at one point now become like, oh, so let's say that, you know, the SI's take on detournement or sort of your engagement with the city would seem to be antagonistic at a certain point. Like 20s, they could say, oh, they're just doing viral marketing. So there's a certain shift, there's a certain way in which the kinds of practices that had a certain resonance at that time almost have their meaning changed by how the context around them changes.
I mean, it's funny actually, because that brings us really quite neatly into this question about kind of work, labor, artistic production. And again, I mean, you sort of, partially because of the influence of autonomous theory, which is deeply engaged with this question, but also in other ways throughout the book, you know, you kind of are in dialogue with ideas about work, labor, things like value. And in some, you know, some respects, this kind of manifests itself as discussions of the idea of the city as a factory or the metropolitan factory, questions about kind of artistic surplus value, you know, the kind of production of value through art, and then feminist readings of the refusal of work. And I wonder if we might pick up on two of those things, partially because they're kind of important in contemporary discussion. So the first thing is this kind of value question, and, you know, kind of how the autonomists read value production by and through art.
It's one of those things where again, I wouldn't say that there's like a thorough sort of field of literature on autonomous readings of value in art. The little things that are out there are things like this little book that Tony Negri wrote, which is supposed to be a series of letters he wrote during the 1980s to people about art practices. I kind of doubt whether they actually were letters, but anyways, yeah. So the way I was approaching it is trying to think about, how do forms of art production, cultural production, specifically create value? So, in the sense that, if let's say you're coming from one approach would be a very orthodox Marxist sort of labor theory of value reading, with this where only certain forms of labor produce value and everything else doesn't. You'd be hard pressed to explain why, let's say, a certain Picasso on painting is worth so much. Is it because it took him so many hours? No, that would be silly. And if you're only looking at sort of values created by market exchange, which is, let's say, kind of a approach taken with someone like Georg Simmel, I think you come up with certain limitations. So what I was trying to understand is, let's say, how there's a forms of what I call circulatory labor. So labors that sort of help to circulate images, ideas, perceptions, move things around within the social milieu. And that has its own particular form of value production. So if you go back to the question of sort of why are certain artists' work worth so much, you can say, oh, well, actually, it's because of the labors undertaken by curators, by people who run museums, who do exhibitions, who all sort of build up kinds of perceptions of worth, or you might, in more traditional business terms, you might say, who build intangible value around the particular practices. So in a certain way, once you say that, you can see how how the divide line between conceptual art practices and sort of marketing and branding starts to get a bit sort of, you know, hazy, right?
And where does, where does this connect us back to strategies?
In the sense that coming out of a sort of autonomous reading where when the autonomous talk about sort of class composition, they mean two things. One, there's a certain technical composition is sort of how labor and value production exists in a certain context. So what kinds of work are happening? How are they operating for capital? Those sorts of things. And the second is sort of political composition, which is sort of what kinds of political possibilities, subjective becomings, kinds of antagonism are possible in that situation. And what I find most interesting is how these two are inherently connected. So for instance, you might say the industrial factory system produces value and disciplines labor in a certain way, but enables a certain kind of resistance or rebellion in it. So in the factory line, you can stop the factory line by doing this, this, or this. Once you have value being produced by much more sort of circulatory, ephemeral means that aren't centrally controlled, you would need a different set of techniques, different set of approaches to interrupt that value production. So it's almost starting from the idea that you need to understand how capitalism is working in its current state in order to try to interrupt it.
I mean, what are the kind of classic? I like that word actually. Interruptions is this concept of the refusal of work, which is obviously kind of well established in autonomous ideas. But I think one of the really kind of important things you do in the book, and actually one of the most sort of positive contributions, is you kind of highlight how feminist theory is important to understanding the refusal of work.
Hmm. Thanks. I'm glad you like that bit. I mean, that comes out of a few things. One is I remember reading this article by Alyssa Del Rey, where one of the things she pointed out is sort of if work refusal, attempting to escape work, is only being done by male factory workers. That means that all the labors of social reproduction, of childcare, of sort of everyday interactions that sustain sociality, that a certain kind of limit refusal work to only certain workers would tend to actually just push work off to primarily, you know, historically what is more activities done by women. So she's saying, well, this is a certain limitation and a certain problem, which I tend to agree with a lot. So I was trying to sort of draw from that insight, as well as Kathy Weeks' book, The Problem with Work, which also sort of brings together feminist theory and work refusal, and things the wages for housework movement. I mean, one of the critiques that was made of wages for housework often is, well, if you succeed, if you manage to get housework paid for, you're just going to be further alienating and commodifying your own labor. And someone like Silvia Federici's response to it is, no, you misunderstood the point here. The point here is that currently these forms of what we consider, you know, to be work, like housework, care work, are being invisibilized and not acknowledged. The point of the wage for housework movement was to give a visibility to a form of labor to be able to struggle over and refuse it. So I guess that's why I'm bringing continuing to develop that idea is how refusal, you know, work refusal, is you can't just magically escape from work by yourself or even you know as a movement. But you need to think about sort of how forms of social reproduction, caring work, all the other forms of work which oftentimes are forgotten about, have to be thought of, and almost. At one point, I'm saying you need to socialize work in order to refuse it.
So we've talked kind of through autonomous theory, through ideas about how capitalism is operating, particular ideas about strategies, about, as we've just done, the refusal of work and understanding the kind of socialized approach to contemporary work. But we haven't really talked about art. So I wonder if we could pick up on the kind of, I guess, almost the kind of core case study that the book uses, which is the story of NSK, and I think I might let you give the kind of the full proper pronunciation of them. But I wonder if you could tell me the story of NSK, and through that kind of telling, bring out some of the broader themes in the book.
Well, I'm not necessarily sure. I would say the NSK is necessarily the core, but I do think they have a particular approach to the questions of art and politics, which made me want to include them. So, for instance, one thing I found interesting about and my German is horrible, so I'm probably going to butcher this as well. Neustadtische Kunst. One of the things they do is they're most interested in, let's say, how the recuperation of, or the sort of the assimilation of previous avant-gardes tended to sort of come with a certain kind of trauma or sort of discomfort in them. So you can think about the ways that, let's say, Russian constructivism in the 20s and 30s got sort of crushed by Stalinism. So certain kinds of art practices sort of got buried or dealt away with. And what they're trying to trace out is what they call the retro avant-garde. So what kinds of lingering, let's say, energies, emotional attachments, anxieties, forms of are attached to these histories. So to give you a nice example, they're best known for their musical wing, which is a band called Liebach. One of the things they do is cover versions of songs, but let's say rework songs in other ways. So do you know the Queen song One Vision?
Yeah.
So here you have this sort of 80s kind of happy, almost synth poppy song about how, and this is written during Live Aid in 86, that, you know, people will come together and change the world for the better. But the funny thing is that's how it sounds when Queen plays it. When you change the lyrics of the course of the song, One Vision, One People, One Solution, into German, and you give it a nice military beat in the background, all of a sudden it becomes much more ominous, you know? So what are they doing by reinterpreting this song in a certain way is, showing how even in apparently, you know, consumer world friendly pop culture, there are elements of, let's say, fascist desire and sort of, let's say, other kinds of unseemliness that are existing. So what they do is the NSK tries to recombine forms of ideas from Dada, surrealism, futurism, with a sort of weird mix of sort of quasi fascist imagery in a way that tries to sort of tease out what kinds of anxieties and traumas are still embedded in these histories. And that's why I think it's quite interesting in that they aren't necessarily, it's not the avant-garde is here is the new thing that will change everything. It's like, well, here's how the operations of previous artistic practices, whether in surrealism or futurism, or in fascist art, are continuing to have an influence on art production today. And so that's why they call it the sort of retro avant-garde. They're trying to sort of trace out more of these histories in a way that sort of reactivates or uses those energies in the present.
I'm quite interested in, and actually this is something that maybe, you know, isn't really actually in the book, but just how did you come across, or how did you become kind of interested in NSK?
I was aware of Liebach as a teenager growing up, listening to the music and also some of the painting of the sort of, let's say, the fine art wing of NSK, which is Irwin. But one thing that particularly happened is, I'm going to get wrong exact year, but in 2007. Okay, so one of the projects that the NSK has is in the early 90s, they launched their own, what they claim to be a global state in time.
Yeah.
So it as Yugoslavia was sort of falling apart, they declared that they were going to create their own state that had no spatial borders, but only time. And so they created this, you know, they started making passports, they started claiming that they were creating their own state. And that was, you know, an interesting sort of gesture, and one of the things that one chapter looks at is that the state and time. But in 2007, I received a message saying that they're rethinking the State and Time Project, and we're going to have a global congress about it in Berlin. So I applied to be a congressman at the sort of at this conceptual art practice of being a state with all time and no territory. And so I went along to that and sort of got interested in how what they were doing could be understood in terms of you know, histories of art practices and how that worked. So that's what got me, let's say, moving from just being casually interested in the NSK in terms of the art they produced to being more interested in how they were organizing.
The organizing thing is fascinating, actually, and I mean you kind of address it in the conclusion, as well as actually bringing in more questions about art. So I guess I might bring in a practical and then this more kind of art theoretical question. So in practical terms, you talk about the kind of like I might summarize it almost as kind of strategy without strategy. And you discuss your conversation with Conrad Becker, I think, you know, and you kind of talk through strategy without strategy. So I guess what would be the kind of I suppose the practical implications of this strategy without strategy?
I guess it would be in a certain way, and this is like one of the main themes of the book, is that when a lot of times when people go and get excited about learning about, let's say, the Situationists or about Laibach and NSK or about the art strike, it's very easy to fall into this idea of like, okay, they did this, this, and this. It worked. Therefore, if we do that today, it will work. It'll have the same effect. You know, if there was a form of art, an interventionist art practice that was really disruptive and powerful in the 60s, well, then it'll be good today. And part of what I'm saying is, well, actually, no. That's the most useful thing to learn, and maybe this is an art historical question or political question, is not necessarily what do they do and how do we redo it today, but more how do particular practices interact with the context that they come out of. And so it's more of learning about this relationship between political aesthetic practices and context that I think is more useful today. And so to think about, let's say, an inheritance of interventionist art practices would be to sort of say, okay, well, here are these things that happened. Here's how they circulated. What can we learn from that today? And how can they be sort of not reused, but almost like necessarily repurposed or redesigned? Because I guess I would say any artistic or political practice which claims it is politically radical is only so in the context in which it emerges. And to sort of learn from that history of inheritance means having to rethink what that relationship was so it can be rethought for the present.
The art of the undercommons, yes. an unanswerable question.
Well, I don't think of the art of the undercommons not being a particular thing, but okay, here's how to explain. The undercommons is the idea that rather than saying now is the time to organize or now is the time to do something politically, to realize that there's always already things happening. There's already forms of political organization, forms of, let's say, almost a bit called implicit critiques of the world, existing world, already circulating. So to give you an example that that Fred Moten used in a few months ago in an interview, he started and ended up talking about barbecues. He says, you know, a lot of people think of barbecues as, you know, just being, you know, a nice thing that happens on a Saturday in a park, right? He says, well, barbecues are actually really socially interesting, rich situations. Where if you look at a barbecue, you have, you know, the person who knows how to prepare the meat, the person who knows how to organize transport, the person who gets together the games for the kids, the person who gets together the drinks for the aunties. But there's so many things that are always already happening in organizing, even something what might seem like a very not complicated situation. So an art of the undercommons would be what forms of aesthetic production, what forms of ideas, images, forms of art are already being circulated in the present. So rather than saying, well, now is, because when you say now is the time to do this, whether it's now is the time to really make political art or now is the time to really organize, that tends to erase everything that was there already. So the art of the other, the idea of the art of the other commons is trying to sort of more tease out what's already happening, or as I suppose as Marvin Gaye would say, what's going on, and to learn from the value and the richness of that rather than just saying, oh, well, now we need to really do something.
So where do you go next after the book? Obviously, I'm sort of conscious of the, you know, the broader question that confronts academics when they finish a research project or a book, which is, yeah, that's very interesting. What are you going to do next? Which seems a bit, you know, kind of demanding and dismissive. But I'm interested to know how you kind of take forward a book like this. Is it, you know, kind of in terms of more sort of organizing more, I guess, movement practices, or are you thinking in terms of, you know, having settled accounts with this question of autonomism in the avant-garde and moving on to something else?
Well, currently what I'm working on is pretty much right after I finished the book, I went on to working on, I'm organizing an exhibition of the work of G. Voucher, who's perhaps best known for being the designer for the anarchist punk band Crass.
Oh, yeah.
And so I worked with a few other people first to get her nominated for an honorary doctorate from the University of Essex, and then to convince First Sight, the big local museum in Colchester, to put together a sort of a retrospective of her work. And that's going to open in November. So that's looking at sort of the past 50 years of her work in terms of painting, collage, design, installation work, print, video, and film. That wasn't something that necessarily comes out of the book, but it does cover, let's say, similar sort of concerns in trying to learn from, let's say, a kind of heritage of, or an inheritance of, sort of political art, and trying to expand how people understand it and what it could mean. And I think it's really interesting that's happening. It's opening in November in Colchester, and that's really interesting because this fall is being celebrated as, you know, the 40th anniversary of punk, which is kind of funny if you look at Punk London. These series of events, which are sort of backed by the Queen and the Mayor and the Lottery, who are perhaps the sort of least punk people in the world. So interesting. So it's a similar sort of question in trying to say, well, okay, what was the, if you start with sort of what was the aesthetic political importance of punk in the 70s? What can we learn from it today? How would it be reworked or sort of recomposed in the present? That sort of thing. So that's what I've been working on at present. I have to admit that since that's taken up so much time with that, I'm not sure where I'm going after that. But we'll see. I suspect we'll probably just think more about questions of sort of cultural labor, and that I think I'm quite interested in ways in which, let's say, forms of artistic and cultural production create a sort of a kind of psychological contract where you're much more subjectively involved in your work and therefore find it harder to organize it around it in terms of labor or politics. So things about like the difficulty of going on art strike when your work is your own subjectivity. So I'll probably work more on that next.
Thanks for listening to New Books and Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Stephen Shukaitis from the University of Essex about his new book, Composition of Movements to Come.